The Western view of what Buddhist practice is almost entirely now oriented by this image of somebody sitting on a meditation cushion, their eyes closed, focus internally. And so in Western Buddhism has become almost synonymous in a way with mindful inner awareness, meditation. And yet, if we considered, and the lifestyle that we Westerners have is generally we are lay practitioners. We either live in alone or share small apartments. We struggle to make the rent. We have busy lives where we balance a lot of different obligations from work and friendships, some of us sobriety, some of us yoga practices, families. And so very often we come to Dharmapunks and to other Buddhist communities, of which there are many in New York, thankfully, to find a way to help us balance all of these obligations in a way that reduces stress in our lives. So very often in Western Buddhism is oriented around the idea of reducing stress so that we can meet all of the demands for our attention. Now, in ancient Southeast Asia or Northeast Asia, a Buddhist practitioner would have had an almost as different a life as imaginable. They would be homeless, familyless, jobless. They would not eat after noon. They would live by 200 strict precepts that pretty much dictated to a great detail what kind of behaviors they could enact. They were living very often in rough conditions in jungle settings. In other parts of the world, I've traveled, for instance, to Southeast Asia, and Buddhist practice there is very different. There is very, very little meditation practice by Buddhists in Southeast Asia. I've read one study was or survey was less than 10% of Buddhists in Southeast Asia or Northeast Asia actively practice meditation, but they do actively engage with the monasteries or the Buddhist centers. There's a very strong community feel. A lot of the ceremonies of day-to-day life are held around the monasteries, and people will bring their children and they will chant very often. So one of the interesting arguments is a lot of Buddhist teachers like to present Buddhism or the Dharma as being centered around the Four Noble Truths. And we are told that these Four Noble Truths are universal and timeless, ahistorical, transcultural. So it's a very similar claim that many Buddhists make, that all of Buddhism revolves around seeing that there are two kinds of suffering. One is inevitable. Old age, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, grief, despair, loss, not getting what we want, getting what we don't want, pain. And then there's all the unnecessary suffering that we add into the mix, taking things personally, resisting the inevitable experiences of life, avoidance, all of the adverse maladaptive coping strategies we fall into as a way to avoid the truths of our lives, the various addictions. substances and behavioral that we add. And then these in these Four Noble Truths, the Dharma proposes that the Buddha said that the cause of the unnecessary suffering in our lives is due to the a kind of craving for life to be other than it is, which actually makes life worse than it need be. Our avoidance of the inevitabilities of life makes life even more painful, more suffering than it needs be. So this claim that the Four Noble Truths are the epicenter of Buddhist practice is made quite frequently. And the claim is that these Four Noble Truths are universal in the sense that all people experience them everywhere at all times. Similar to Freud made the claim that the Oedipus stage, he believed, was timeless. Levi-Strauss made his anthropological, anthropologist? Yes, he was an anthropologist. and he believed that his structural claims about human culture were timeless. And so in many ways, we could look at Buddhism as, from this perspective, as a kind of structural statement about the mind. And backing this up would be people who add, well, suffering is pretty universal, is it not? There's a lot of it we see, a lot of people who make their lives more difficult. And certainly we're all using a very similar neurobiology. Human beings are extremely genetically similar in that we rarely intermix with other species and create genetic abnormalities. We are very similar. So you could make a case, but that would be made difficult by a couple of problematic issues. The first is that everywhere Buddhism has gone, to every culture, it has been deeply influenced and changed by those cultures. As Buddhism went north through Nepal to Tibet, it encountered the Bon practice that preceded it to that region, and it became Tibetan Buddhism, which is filled with amazing rituals, prostrations, visualization meditations, wonderful practices, not to mention the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is an acid trip in and of itself. So much so that Richard Albert and Timothy Leary made it a big hit in the 1960s, and there was a practice of taking acid and reading the book and trying to re-experience what it was predicted one would experience in the transmigration of one's consciousness after death. I, like everyone else of my age, tried that and didn't get anywhere with it. Took a whole bunch of peyote and just freaked out and didn't have anything near what they described. Would have loved to, but so much for that. When Buddhism went into China and Japan, it encountered Taoist philosophy, and then Zen and Chan Buddhism was created, which is a beautiful spiritual path filled with an appreciation of natural, spontaneous human potential, especially that which transcends the sort of limitations of the rational mind. And a lot of Zen practice focuses around not only koan practice, which pushes the mind against its limitations of reason, but there's a lot of its own very beautiful, beautiful ritual practices, wonderful gongs and bells and chanting in Japanese and the Heart Sutra. It's really lovely. And in Southeast Asia, there's a very different flavor. And in Western Buddhism, I've been a Buddhist since my dad converted when I was 12, and I was dragged with him to various Buddhist centers and started reading and became more and more involved. And but I teach a very psychological brand of Buddhism influenced by aspects of the Theravada. But I'm probably as different a Buddhist from a, I'm sure that if you sat down next to me, a Zen monk, he would struggle to recognize a lot of what I teach as similar to his Dharma. There is a huge variety of Buddhist practices, and in fact, it's not only different from Zen to Tibetan to Pure Land to Theravadin to secular Buddhism. People like myself and Stephen Batchelor and other secular Buddhists, but even the Buddha himself had a lot of variations. If you read, which I have spent too many years to count, studying the Pali Canon, in one sutta, the Buddha can say, just this is the path to liberation. And then he'll launch off on a lesson of concentrating the mind on the breath. And you go, okay, well, then maybe that's the path. But then two suttas later, just this is the path to liberation. And he'll talk about finding wise spiritual friendships. And you go, oh, okay. And then next, just this is the path. And he'll talk about mindfulness. No, just this is the path. He'll talk about right effort, knowing which thoughts are skillful and which thoughts are not skillful. Just, and he goes on and on. And in fact, I don't know if I've ever counted, but there's got to be at least 40 or 50 different just this paths that the Buddha lists as the one that will take you exclusively to liberation. So this raises the question, is everything relative? Can anything be called the Dharma? At what point is something not the Dharma? Or what can we perhaps more constructively, safely say are trends or tendencies within the various different articulations of the Dharma that are similar, so that if somebody asks us, hey, what's this Buddhism stuff that you seem to be interested in, you might be able to have or construct some kind of meaningful response. I'd like to propose a couple of things, which will then bring me to the core topic for tonight. One tendency that we see throughout every brand of Buddhism that I am aware of is the Buddha's statement. There's a core statement the Buddha said that everything I teach is for the ending of suffering. And that suffering, we understand, is not the inevitable suffering of life. The Buddha does not claim to be able to rid you of pain or the grief of losing a loved one or the difficulties of aging and sickness. But he does claim that what he teaches in some way will help you not add more agitation and misery to your life than is necessary. He will provide you, he is suggesting, and I shouldn't even be genderizing the Buddha because I have no way of knowing if he was a man or a woman or anything. And so let's just say that the promise is made that the amount of suffering, agitation, stress, worry, anxiety, fear that we add to life will be reduced. Second tendency, I'd say, is that every version of Buddhism, whether it's the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, the Five Faculties, the Seven Factors, there's so many lists that the Buddha taught, but he never taught a one-fold path. He always taught that there was a requirement for balance always in the Dharma. And at the very least, that balance involves not just internal awareness, but also if we want to have some reduction of suffering in our life, he called for a external life where we did not cause harm to ourselves or others. So there's not only an emphasis upon mindful meditation or internal awareness, it always has to be counterbalanced by investigating how we interact with the world around us. Are we causing, exploiting, harming, manipulating, abusing, sidestepping, or in any way causing harm? And it's that investigation in and of itself that is, for me, the practice. There's no way you're going to ever get to a life where you're not causing any harm, but the constant investigation and setting the intention to reduce the harm that we cause is as much a part of our journey as sitting on the cushion. So I pose that that's a second fundamental. The third is that every form of Dharma that I have familiarized myself and I've practiced in when I was a kid, the Zen tradition, and then in my 20s in the Tibetan and for the last 25 years in the Theravada, and I'm not aware of any Buddhism that claims that there is an ultimate category or idea that can interpret reality without fail. There's an emphasis on the Dharma that all ideas, categories, representations of reality at the end must be seen as fallible, that there is no ultimate way to view, narrate, or represent the truth. And there's always, the Buddha says in the Dhammapada, and there's a quote of this similarly throughout every form of the Dharma that I'm aware of, where the Buddha says that the world and our experience is always constructed by the mind, which is a recognition that there's always a subjectivity in our experience, that we are not perceiving things as they really are, and furthermore, that there is no way to arrive at some fundamentally last word on the truth. In fact, the Buddha constantly undermines truth claims. He, in suttas such as the Sakka Sutta and elsewhere, says that people who make truth claims invariably wind up in causing conflict, because we can argue together over what is the truth. And we can constantly frame the truth differently. In various regions of the world that you're familiar with, people do this with excellence. They frame conflict in ways that constantly make each side of an equation seem the victim and the other side the oppressor. So the truth claims are always problematized in the Dharma. And this brings me to my fourth claim, which would be that, if I'm making any claims, that the ultimate point of spiritual practice is to always provide us with a different perspective on our lives. It's not about telling us how to perceive our lives, but giving us different ways to perceive our lives. I work not only as a teacher, but as a one-on-one Buddhist mentor, and that's where I spend a lot of my hours of the week, meeting with people. And by and large, a lot of people arrive seeking help who have organized their lives entirely around the principles that are espoused in capitalism, which are achieving financial security at all costs, trying to find that special someone that will fix and complete our lives, accumulating or accomplishing some creative project. So we often organize our entire perspectives on who we are, how far we've come from those. And also there's a very strong tendency to promote in our culture competition with others, to see and to think, to get a sense of how well am I doing by comparing myself with the people I went to school with. Oh, shit, they've got a novel. They've got a movie out. They've got all these kids. I don't really want them, but... So we can perceive our lives always through a prism, and those prisms can make us feel that we are failing mightily. The beauty of having a practice is that we are provided again and again with different tools to interpret our lives, our experiences, the events of our days, our weeks, our months, not from the perspective of the dominantly, hegemonically produced people that in New York, the first thing they ask is, what's your job, to define who we are? But to have other ways of appreciating and filtering and understanding and interpreting our lives. In Buddhism, there's various tools, appreciating impermanence, appreciating the emptiness of all things and that all things are constantly changing and don't have any underlying core entity. The appreciation of beauty in nature, the appreciating of the natural unfolding of life, the arising and passing of strengths and skills, the flow that is existence. There's so many different ways we can interpret, especially when you have a practice and you sit and you just become aware of the amazing quality of being in a breathing body. To have that brought to mind can so undermine the achievement, you know, narrative of I've got to do this and get that done and run here and accomplish that, and why haven't I written my second play or whatever. The being in the body doesn't compare us with other people, and it doesn't have any sense of, oh, I'm really doing pretty poorly these days. If you're in a body that's breathing and it's got all these organs that are working together and it's producing consciousness, from that perspective, everybody in this room is doing amazingly well. Because when you think about it, a hell of a lot could go wrong at any moment. So it's really quite a miraculous achievement that we're even sitting here. Sometimes I think that even more times than others. It's amazing. So, and this idea of relativism doesn't devalue Buddhist practice in any way, shape, or form. Relativism, the idea that context matters in the world, doesn't devalue our practice. In fact, it invites more people in, the less we make actual claims about what practice needs to be. To keep it as simple as simply being aware of what's going on internally, trying to not cause harm externally, and to let go of our fixed beliefs, to open ourselves to other perspectives. If you use that as your explanation of your practice, I can't foresee you scaring too many people away. Not that I want you to proselytize, because I really don't want you to proselytize, but that to me is a very nice understanding of what we're doing. It's interesting. One of my favorites, somebody I don't talk about too much because it sounds really pompous and insane to mention him, but a philosopher, Husserl, that was the founder of modern phenomenology, said that the mind always intends to objects in the world, but in this process of intending towards objects, it always translates or invariably translates complex objects that can be seen from so many different perspectives into what he called intentional content, which is, in other words, concepts, language, ideas. And in doing that, the real is constantly being eroded and turned into something other. There's this constant slippage from the powerful awareness of life in and of itself that is always simplified and reduced the moment we turn it into a story and into an idea, into a view, into an opinion. When I was young, my dad, in addition to dragging me to listen to various weird Japanese Buddhist teachers, he also would take me to galleries and we'd look together at minimalist art. And minimalist art was quite a big thing at the time. And basically all it was a big square sculpture. That was it, just a big square. I don't know why I'm making that sound. It was like they must have been heavy, so it went boom when they dropped in. It would be like a painting, but it would be all black. There'd be no content, or all white. And you look at it, and because there was absolutely no complexity to it, it was just you and the thing, it would force the viewer to constantly revisit how they were interpreting the object and to call attention to every moment we confront life. When we confront something, we're changing it. We're turning it into an idea, a story, a view. We're trying to figure out what it means. We're trying to add an interpretation. And that movement was always frustrating because there was never an interpretation readily available with this art. You just had to look, and you always knew that no matter what you were interpreting it as, you know, what the hell is this guy doing? He's just putting a big square in the middle of this gallery, and there's nothing more to it. And it would force one to confront just how much damage and violence sometimes we can be doing with the way we interpret our lives, the way we interpret our experience, how arbitrary it can be, and how incessant this need to have a story or a view or an opinion can be, rather than just being with things in and of themselves. So I'll conclude by referencing a contemporary psychologist named Edward De Bono. He's an Italian psychologist, and I think he's Italian. I don't know where he's from. Sounds Italian. And he has this idea, which he's spread about to various different schools, academies, businesses, and it works very, very well. It's called the six hats idea. And basically it goes like this. He proposes that most people over the course of their lives develop limiting interpretations and behaviors and creative practices in their lives. They look at things from the same way and they identify with their views. And they become unable to think in different ways. They're constantly just reverting back to the single way they look at life, whether it's financial security, or have I achieved what I want to achieve, or have I met that special person, or whatever. And he argues that the beauty of the human mind is that it can be trained to constantly look at life from different angles, different perspectives. And so he proposes six perspectives or six hats. And he says that each of us should practice putting on and taking off these hats so that we learn how to not get stuck in how we perceive any challenge that we face. The first hat is the white hat, and that's just look at the basic facts, figures, bottom line, without anything else. Can we, how could we, if we were just going to put it as simply as possible, how would we describe the challenge before us, whether it's writing something or finding a new roommate or moving into a new apartment or seeking a new place to live or moving or whatever challenge we face, just what is the bare facts? Just state that in the mind and just be able to say the challenge without embellishing on it. The second hat is yellow, which is what is the most optimistic view imaginable. This will all work out great. It'll just, if I just do this, everything will work out great. And most of us will find the yellow hat to be extremely unnatural, especially if you're from my family. The neurotic New York education does not prepare us for wearing the yellow hat very well. So what is the most optimistic outcome? The least amount of work and everything will turn out well. And what will we need to do for the most optimistic outcome to be achieved? Now, guess what the next hat is the black hat. And most of us, or many of us in this room, will find the black hat to be the most natural hat that we put on first. It's the catastrophizing, worst possible scenario, caution. It's all going to fall apart for this reason, and therefore I have to do what to prepare myself? What would that be? To prepare myself for the worst possible outcome. That might be often the case. Just sit there, duck and cover. That was what they did during the... And then my favorite hat is the green hat. The red hat. Let me get to the red hat first. The red hat is allow yourself to have any emotional response you want. From anger to remorse to guilt to frustration. Why do I have to face this challenge again? And just listen to that and allow yourself to have your most emotional response. Not your most catastrophic. See if you can keep your catastrophic from your emotional response. And then the green hat, my favorite hat, is what would somebody who thought entirely differently than I, how would they interpret this? An interpretation that's so different than the way I've ever looked at the world, ever experienced reality, a completely out-of-the-box, unusual, sometimes we might need to even call somebody, or just visualize somebody that you know thinks completely different than you do, and just ask them in your mind, well, how would you interpret this? And just, you'll clench when you hear it because it'll be so unlikely. The out-of-the-box, seemingly Martian view, the foreign view to me. And finally, the last is the blue hat, which is the hat that keeps the big picture in life in mind. Does this really matter in the end? Will, as I look back on my life, this have any import anyway? How much time in my life should I be spending chewing on this dilemma? And really, haven't I listened to enough of the black hat already? Isn't it time to switch to the green or the red or the yellow or the white or any other hat? So, to me, this is another variation of our practice, the systematically looking at each event and challenge of life from a different perspective, other than what we gravitate towards the most easily or what we've been programmed by our parents or our society, to always look at it from a different opportunity, the financial challenge we face, looking at it from a different perspective. Whatever it is that crops up in our life, can we systematically find different perspectives? If we are doing that, I would contend we are fully moving along in our journey. So I thank you for listening. I hope you will find something of value. And just listening to the sounds of the room. Good way to, when you close your eyes and the visual experience is no longer presenting data to the mind. So what happens is the mind might, and for a little while after you close your eyes, feel a little bit constrained in the body, so you can open up and create a sense of space by bringing awareness to the full landscape of sound that is arising and passing. Hearing the sounds of cars, rain from the street, the occasional sounds of heating through the pipes, and then feeling the contact you're making with your cushion or whatever you're sitting on. Just feel those sensations. The touch of clothes on the body. And the feel of arms on legs. So all of this is what's called contact sensations. And then there are the field of sensations entirely emanating from the body itself. The most apparent of which naturally being the sensations of the breath, which we'll call attention to in a moment, but just feel the other ambient sensations available to awareness, such as the slight feel of, say, the palms of the hands and the fingers, feelings of heat, solidity, a slight tingling, and then another area of the body, perhaps the feeling of the feet, the muscles at the very back of the neck where the shoulders meet with the neck. A general awareness of all the variety of sensations from heat to cold, lightness and solidity, tingling and numbness, pain and ease in the body. And finally, bringing awareness to the waves of movement in the body synonymous with the breath. So it's useful to bring awareness to the breath as a way to develop a still mind, keeping one thing in your awareness, whether it's the breath, or if you don't like working with the breath, no worries, you can simply recite in the mind a phrase such as, may I feel ease and peace, may I feel safe. Or you can hold an image, a place you feel very secure. Try not to turn it into a story. Just hold the image or a very simple shape in the mind. If you do want to work with the sensations of the breath, try not to visualize or add anything beyond just awareness of the sensations of breathing in and breathing out. If it's difficult to keep the breath in mind, if you find your mind always being pulled away by memories or random thoughts that appear, a good strategy is to count 1 on the in-breath, 2 on the out, 3 on the in, 4 on the out-breath, 5 on the in, and then back down, 4 on the out, 3 on the in, 2 on the out. And so you're counting up and down from 1 to 5, with 1, 3, and 5 always on the in-breath. If you'd like to practice insight, you can let go of holding or maintaining awareness of the breath or the metaphrase or the image, and just allow your awareness to be as spacious and open as possible. Once again, aware of all the sensations available to you in the present, the sounds, sensations of touch, contact, even becoming aware of the light flickering perhaps behind the eyelid, the shifting states of awareness, times feeling tired and drowsy, or feeling anxious and alert, jumpy, feeling pulled away into thought, or just relaxing nicely in the present. The different feelings arising in the body, the tightness in the belly, sometimes the shoulders contracting, releasing, muscles in the face clenching, softening. So as thoughts appear, and thoughts can be visual thoughts like little inner movies, or they can be word-based thoughts that you hear in your mind, almost like you're hearing a podcast or something. Or a combination sometimes of both images and words. And as these thoughts appear, very often the mind will want to abandon awareness of all the other impressions and sensations that are occurring in the present. And it will want to identify entirely with these thoughts and become lost in thoughts, as it were. So see if you can use all the other sensations available to you, the sounds, contact, body, breath, as a way not to get pulled into thought. And when these thoughts appear, see if you can note how they affect the body. Does the breath become shallower or faster? Does your mind feel more anxious or more tired? Can you be with the thought without climbing into it or pushing it away? Just allowing it, welcoming it, but not getting caught up. Seeing how each thought affects the rest of your experience. Eventually, when we welcome thoughts and allow them to be there and don't get caught up in their content, eventually they begin to dissipate We don't need to push them away, argue with them, or agree. This is another way to be with all of our experience. And so on to the transition from the meditation to a more balanced awareness. Bringing to mind an image of yourself as you sit and noting that this is a person who is trying to cultivate some ease and peace internally. A practice that removes us from addictively seeking happiness from consuming substances or addictive behaviors. It removes us from conflict from others, with others, removes us from all the unskillful tendencies around us. A blameless practice that is available to us anytime we wish, that cultivates both patience, awareness, focus, tolerance, all of these attributes we develop when we bring our awareness internally and simply stay mindfully with our experience. So you have something that is utterly beautiful in your life. And just note that. And finally, when you hear the sound of the bowl indicating it's time to feel invited to open your eyes, try to do that as gradually and slowly as you can. You simply open your eyes quickly, all the sights of the room will flood in, and awareness of the breath and the body and the sounds and the sensations of being alive will be pushed out by the busyness of the world around us. And so if you can slowly open your eyes and purposefully rebalance the awareness of sight with all the richness of your internal experience, that's actually a very wonderful practice.